On this month's Disney DVD podcast, Ross King talks to Mark Dindal, the director of Chicken Little.
When you've got a great director like Gary Marshall, I just wondered, is he happy just to be the voice talent, or does he want to throw in a little bit of directing too?
No, he's really good about being the voice talent. He turned to me after one session and he said, I know what it's like. If you're not getting what you want, just give me a line reading.
And Academy Award winner for Best Makeup for The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Howard Berger.
Now, who threw the best party on the night?
I have to say Vanity Fair was pretty spectacular. And they said, do you have tickets? And we went, no. And they went, sorry, this is a private party. And we rolled the windows down and stuck two Oscars out. And they went, oh, I'm sorry, go right ahead. You have the best ticket in town.
Hi, Ross King here with Disney DVD's inaugural Celebrity Pod Call for March 2006. Yes, you heard it right. This is a pod call. Now, each month, I'll phone some of Hollywood's biggest stars and some of the talented folks behind the hottest Disney movies coming soon to DVD. And today, we'll call Mark Dindal, the director of Disney's animated hit Chicken Little, available on DVD March 21st.
Chicken Little! What is it? What's going on?
The sky is falling! The sky is falling!
Look, Mama, there's the crazy chicken!
Yes, it is, crazy little chicken. You're so smart. We don't make eye contact. Bye-bye.
Today is a new day.
Let's give Mark Dindal a call.
Hello?
Hello, Mark.
Ross, how are you?
I'm good. Yes, it's Ross King, and you're on my Celebrity Pod Call.
Oh.
Hey, how good is that?
That's fantastic.
Now, congratulations on the success of Chicken Little. We mentioned available on DVD March 21st. For those who don't, and there's not that many, but there may be one or two, give us the brief story of Chicken Little.
Well, this story really all started when I was thinking one day about the idea of Chicken Little and the sky falling, and I thought it would be a fun idea if no sooner had Chicken Little gotten over the whole embarrassment and lived down that horrible moment when a piece of the sky fell. No sooner has he done that another piece of the sky falls on him and his troubles start all over again. And so from that, we really launched into the story that we ended up with.
I'm always fascinated how people actually get on board for these things. So how did you get involved?
I always thought it was kind of fun to think about these simple fairy tales or folk tales and imagine a bigger life behind those stories. So in the case of Chicken Little, I was imagining, this kid says the sky's falling, and then, if he had to go to school the next day and live down that embarrassment, or if he had to face his dad, who he embarrassed by doing this, what would a life of that character be like? And I just always thought of, Little Red Riding Hood, The Three Little Pigs, all of these stories in that respect. And then one day, like I said, I was just driving home and I thought, Chicken Little, this time the sky really is falling. What if this kid, this thing happened to him again, and this time he's actually right?
So now, for you to get the job as director, how does that come about? I mean, do you have to audition? Do you take meetings? How does it work?
Well, at Disney, I had just finished The Emperor's New Groove, and the producer, Randy Fulmer, and I really wanted to work on another project together, and we actually started thinking about this before Emperor's New Groove was finished in 2000. So about maybe 3 months before we were done, we started thinking about this idea, and we got our story team thinking on it as well. So since I already had a relationship with Disney and it was established as a director, I just pitched it as the next idea that I'd like to do, and we kind of worked from there. So I kind of had an inside track already.
It's always good. Now, you've got a great all-star cast. You've got Zach Braff, Steve Zahn, you've got John Cusack, a man who's not only a great director, but a great voice talent, the man who brought his Pretty Woman, Princess Diaries, Gary Marshall. I mean, the list goes on and on. So what was it like working with these guys?
Oh, this cast was just fantastic. Each one of them, Gary and Don Knotts and Zach, each one of these people, Joan, Steve Zahn, I had always thought they had terrific voices for animation. And, you just kind of log these names in the back of your head, hoping someday there would be a part in one of these movies that they would be perfect for. And this movie had so many parts that were so perfect for so many of the people that I've really admired over the years. And, you know, we chose all of them. They were our first choice. The only audition that we really did was for Chicken Little. We were trying to find a unique voice, and we probably had about 40 actors come in and audition. And when Zach came in, he was so prepared. He had really thought it through, and it was one of those moments, 5 seconds into the audition, Randy and I looked at one another and said, oh, this is good. This is the guy. You know, it just, he captured Chicken Little's spirit and enthusiasm, and then there was, you know, a vulnerability in his voice as well that I really liked.
When you've got a great director like Gary Marshall, I just wondered, is he happy just to be the voice talent, or does he want to throw in a little bit of directing too?
No, he's really good about, you know, being the voice talent. And what was great is that he turned to me after one session, and he said, you know, I know what it's like. If you're not getting what you want, just give me a line reading. You know, he just knows, you know, what it can be like when you have something in particular in your head and you're just not, it's just not coming through. And sometimes, you know, you have just the way that it's been boarded and just the way you want to hear it. And, you know, it's really hard for the actor to know that unless you just give them a line reading. But it's something I always hesitate to do because it's not that much fun for them. It's not that creative. And for the most part, you know, I don't know that, I mean, every once in a while I might have thrown out the way I heard it, but I so loved the interpretation each actor brought that it really, you know, it never became a problem. But he, like all of them, he came prepared with ideas. He had read the script. He had thought it over. He had jokes. A lot of the lines, Chicken Little's dad's lines, Buck Cluck, a lot of his lines came out of Gary's improv.
Now, I know that you had so much going on in your head, but I just wondered, any of the characters modeled after their celebrity counterparts at all?
You know, what we do is we videotape the actors as they read the lines, and it's really an aid for the animators because they look at those videotapes and we'll get just small expressions from the actor. Don Knotts' character, Mayor Turkey Lurkey, there's just some classic expressions that Don would do, and the animator would, you know, look at those, the animators would look at those and get, you know, ideas. And translate that Don's expressions onto this turkey. So every once in a while, yeah, the actor's facial expressions do inform the way that the character looks.
Now, Chicken Little, as I mentioned, available on DVD March 21st. Now, you've got a huge background in animation. I just wonder what you prefer, though, the animating or the directing?
Well, you know, now I really love the directing, and the thing that I really love about it is going into a room, you know, I have to do my homework, I have to have a clear idea, I have to be able to communicate that clearly, but once I do that, what I really love is to just see what each artist will come up with. You know, you give them an idea, you send them off on their way. What I love is that each one of them is a specialist in what they do, so they come back with something beyond what I was imagining. For example, Joe Mosier, one of the character designers that I worked with, I would talk about, the character of, in the end of the movie, when Hollywood does their version of Chicken Little's story. And they depicted Chicken Little as a huge action hero. And so I described the kind of feeling I'd want to see, and he came back with proportions just exaggerated even beyond what I was thinking, which was pretty extreme. So you get that huge barrel chest and that narrows down to that tiny little waist, the sunglasses that he's wearing, even though he's, you know, out in outer space, where they don't, you know, it doesn't even really make particular sense. He just had a lot of great ideas that he brought to it.
Now, Chicken Little was Disney's first in-house produced feature film that was made entirely in CG. Now, I just wondered about the pressures that put on you, and also just explain a little about CG for people who don't know.
Well, CG is computer graphic animation, the process of making the movie is somewhat the same. You know, as far as the storytelling goes, it's actually exactly the same as a traditional animated movie. There's nothing different about the process. You storyboard and you try and figure out character details and all of that. And we work the same visual development as you design characters and locations. But then the tool, the computer, enables you to realize all of those things in a three-dimensional sense. So we really, what we end up doing is virtually making a kind of a live-action movie in this tiny little computer box, because those environments are virtually real. They exist in three-dimensional space, as do the characters. And so, you just have these fantastic artists that know how to manipulate the environment and the characters to make what eventually you see on the screen. As far as the challenge of it being the first CG movie, for me, I didn't think about that as a scary thing. I just was ready for to dive into something new and to go down a different avenue than the traditional path which I had been doing since 1980 at Disney, and really something that I really was interested in ever since I was about 6 years old. So I was excited about this new medium to see what it could do and what sort of effects you could get up on the screen with it.
It's always good to be first and to be there at the beginning. Any unexpected problems, though, that you encountered with CG?
Oh, there was a problem every other week, with the things that we wanted to do. Just figuring out how to realize some of these ideas that we came up with. A good example is just the wind blowing through leaves, blowing through the fur of the characters. You come up with ideas like that you can easily represent in a storyboard sketch, but it requires some R&D and some real heavy thinking to figure out how to get each one of Chicken Little's, he's got like 50,000 feathers on his head, and to get each one of those feathers to react to a current of wind that's blowing from left to right. So we would dream up this stuff, and I could always tell if we had pushed the limit slightly, because I would explain it to Steve Goldberg, who was really the point person for me in terms of the computer production. And I would explain it to him, and he'd always get this kind of half smile, and he'd nod his head. And I'd say, "Can you do that?" And he said, "No, we'll think about it." It's just I could tell that it was a new problem, but the thing that I loved is this group of people. Every time I came up with something, even if they sounded a little nervous at first, they went away and they came back and they solved it. And that happened, over the 5.5 years that we made the movie, that happened repeatedly. It seemed to me like, every 3 weeks they would outdo themselves. So much so that the way that a scene was done at one point, if you try to access that same scene or do, a scene similar a year later, it was impossible because the technology had moved so far forward. So things were becoming obsolete really quickly on this movie.
Now, you mentioned R&D. For those people who don't know, and that does include me, what exactly does that mean?
Oh, that's just research and development. You have to go away and you have to think and figure out how to write software or write a program that will achieve whatever you've dreamt up. And there was one time Randy and I were walking past the group that had a dry erase board filled with mathematical equations. And we just looked at it and we asked them, what are you guys doing? And they were figuring out, it was something that had to do with fur, the way to have fur stay on a character, and if that character should stretch his proportions as if a character is reaching for a ledge or something, and we might in animation stretch their arm a little bit further than just for an exaggerated effect. The fur has to stay in place. You don't want it to do weird things and that would look odd. And they were trying to just figure out something that had to do with the way that the fur would stay on, lay on the character. But, what was fascinating, it was just literally a dry erase board filled with math. And they were looking at it, and they, in their head, could see the result, but you know, to anyone else is looking at that, and it just looks like a, you know, a trigonometry final nightmare, you know, from high school. And it's just amazing to me. It's like it's the same sort of skill that a musician has when they can look at a piece of sheet music and hear it, and that's the skill that these guys had. It's just amazing.
Well, if it was good enough for Alfred Hitchcock to put himself in his own movies, I love the fact that you directed this one and you're in your own movie.
Porcupine, porcupine.
Yo.
Porcupine, porcupine.
Yeah.
It's you.
That is me, yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, we do a lot of scratch dialogue, which is just the rough dialogue before we, sometimes before we get the actors in, just because of schedules. And as we're building our story reels, which are essentially the storyboard drawings put to film with music and dialogue and sound effects, sometimes we will record voices, our own voices, in as a holding sort of, you know, to hold the place for until we get the real actor. And so I just, you know, I did that when we were doing this Porcupine character, and it seemed funny, and people seemed to laugh, and we thought, you know, it's not like a huge, huge role. I think he has 5 words in the whole movie, and so it just stuck, and so we just left it there. I got to do a couple others. The gym teacher, the physical education teacher, is I got to do that as well, sort of patterned after my elementary school gym teacher, had kind of that rhythm and cadence to his voice. So it's a fun thing. It's a fun thing, too, to see your voice come out of these characters on the big screen.
Well, it's a great, fun DVD. It's available March 21st, Chicken Little. And, of course, everyone wants to know what's special about the DVD. We want to know about the extras and everything.
Well, this DVD has an awful lot of deleted scenes that all were in the film at one time. Over the course of 5.5 years, we explored many avenues. The biggest change we made was to change Chicken Little from a girl to a boy. The very earliest versions, he was a boy, and then switched it to a girl character, and we went down that path for probably a year. And so there are some scenes on there from when Chicken Little was a girl. And then at one point we realized just, you know, it's one of those things where you go down these paths, you explore it, and you're just trying to find the right proportion, the right dynamic for the story you want to tell. And what really turned out to be the best for this particular story was to have the Chicken Little as a boy develop the father-son story, the story of a kid trying to make his dad proud. And so we switched him to a boy character and switched the Ugly Duckling from a boy to a girl character. And then everything just started to fall into place. But it's just one of those things where you have to just stay with it and keep working. And as a result, we have a lot of deleted scenes from all of our versions over the years. There's a bunch of, should be a bunch of stuff after 5.5 years. I think we had a lot of artwork and a lot of things to show.
One of my favorite bits, the karaoke piece with the Bare Naked Ladies song, One Little Slip. I just wonder what it was like working with the band.
Oh, I think they've been together maybe almost 20 years, and they have such a great relationship. They were incredibly collaborative, but the great thing that I noticed when I was watching them work is they are so in tune with one another that they have this wonderful way of focusing on the song. You know, in the studio, they're, you know, let's do a take. They focus on it, and they're all there, and then just as quickly, once that take was done, they would just flip into this kind of goofing around mode that they, you know, that somebody would start, you know, playing something on one of the instruments, and then another would join in, and then Ed or Steve would start singing lyrics just off the fly, and they would go off and just goof around, almost like there was the tension of focusing, and then they blew off steam. And then they get right back into the focus again. And it was a great kind of rhythm to watch. They had a real sense of the importance of the playing around, and how that probably, maybe, you know, I just assumed loosened them up to to focus on when they actually had to record. So that was kind of a fun thing to see that. Because a lot of times, you know, you can work with people that are just serious 8 hours a day. And I like, I really relate to this idea of having fun and then being able to quickly focus on what you need to do at the same time. And they are just, they're fantastic at it.
My favorite fascinating fact of this year was that at one point, all the five movies named for Best Picture at the Oscars had not collectively made as much money as Chicken Little. So I just wondered, you deserve an Oscar.
Well, thank you. We just have so much fun. We got to have a good time making these because they take so long. So you've really got to enjoy the process. And so that's a big thing to focus on and really to keep in your head. I mean, obviously you want to go out and be successful, which it was. And then, you know, awards and things like that on top of all that would be great too. But it's good to keep a perspective about the importance of the process, since that takes up so much of the time, and you know, feel good and be proud of that. And I really am, because I just had the luck to work with a wonderful bunch of people.
Well, I love it, Mark, a director who likes to have fun, and it's been great fun talking to you today. Thanks again for joining us, Mark. All the very best.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Mark Dindal, the director of Chicken Little, available in DVD March 21st.
Once a king or queen of Narnia, always a king or queen.
For Narnia! And for Aslan!
My next guest is one of the best makeup and creature designers in the business. He won an Academy Award for his work in the mega hit The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and that's available on DVD April 4th. Let's give Howard Berger a call.
Hello.
Hello, Howard. It's Ross King. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, no, thanks for having me.
No, congratulations on the Oscar. More about that in a moment. Congratulations on the huge success of The Chronicles of Narnia. We're going to witness the magic all over again when it comes out on DVD on April the 4th. But I want to clear up, first of all, when we say makeup, now we're not really talking about, you know, foundation and blusher and just stopping the actors from being shiny. We're talking about creature design, prosthetics,
right,
all that kind of stuff. That's right, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. It actually falls under, it's called special makeup effects. So it's several notches above, you know, straight makeup or corrective makeup or beauty makeup. And it involves, you know, changing an actor's appearance with the use of, like, prosthetics, mechanical heads, suits, and so forth. And that's really what we do. You know, we create all these crazy creatures and characters. And, you know, for Narnia, what we wanted to do is I really believed in 100%. I believed in all the characters we were doing. So I never called them monsters or creatures, really. They were Narnian inhabitants.
The actual work that you do yourself, how involved do you get? I mean, you obviously design this stuff, but then, I mean, do you get to a point where you actually stick the nose on or anything like that?
I actually just sit around and yell at people. No, I don't do that. No, I'm very, very involved. I mean, when we're prepping the show, I mean, we built everything at K&B FX Group, Inc., myself and my co-partner, Greg Nicotero, and we, co-designed everything along with Weta Workshop, Richard Taylor's company in New Zealand that did the Lord of the Rings films, and also worked on Narnia doing armor and weaponry. But we basically had a crew of 120 people working at our shop, which is in Van Nuys, California, and we built everything for 6 months, and then we ended up shipping it all to New Zealand, where I went with a very small United States crew, about 9 people, and there I ended up hiring a crew of 42 people that were a mix of, like I said, people from the United States, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and even Ireland.
Now, how do you actually get involved in the whole business? Because I wonder, I can't imagine you're at school and they say, what do you want to be when you leave school? And you say, I want to be a creature designer or whatever.
Well, actually, it did kind of go that way.
Really?
When I grew up in a film family. My father was a post-production sound editor, and so I was raised on movies, and I was born and raised here in California in the San Fernando Valley. And I knew I loved monsters and I loved movies. So what a perfect combination. So when I was about 8 years old, I really looked into it, and there wasn't the schooling or any literature really. So I just kind of had to make it up as I went along and, learned how to sculpt and paint and draw and just looked at, could find all the photos I could find in like famous monsters magazine to try to just replicate those, you know, what those things look like. And, you know, it obviously you do, you're 8 years old, you do a job of an eight year old, but as I got older and older, I got better and better. And my parents finally looked at it one day and went, you know, I think he's going to do this as a profession. He's pretty darn good at it. And I did. And I was lucky enough to meet Stan Winston, who, did the Terminator and Jurassic Park and Aliens. He's magnificent. And I met him when I was 12 years old, and he let me come to the shop and visit, and I really learned a lot from him, you know, so that was a really big step up. And I just kept working and working at it until I got out of high school. And when I got out of high school, I got hired at Stan Winston Studios to work on Aliens and Predator, and not Alien versus Predator, but Aliens by itself and Predator by itself. And, you know, the rest is history.
Now, you've mentioned some great movies there, but I would imagine with Narnia, this was an experience all of its own.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you what, it's the greatest experience of my life. I loved working on this film, and I remember I'm best friends with Richard Taylor, and Rich and I met on Hercules and Xena in New Zealand, and we always wanted to do something together. And when Narnia came up, I had met with Richard was in town in L.A., and he had said, well, I just had this meeting with this director, Andrew Adamson, and they're doing Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I thought, wow, I would just love to be on that film. But I said, well, Weta's going to do it. They're designing. So when the came time for them to, you know, work on the film, Richard was committed to King Kong and couldn't do it. So he said, Howard, you need to do this movie. This is a film for you. Now, before this happened, I would go down to New Zealand all the time and holiday with Richard. And they were working on the Rings film, and they all believed so much in that world, in Middle Earth, and all the characters that were in the film. And I just wish that someday I could work on a film where I believe so fully that all this existed. And when this movie came up, you know, I had to do it. And I met Andrew 6 months prior to getting hired, and I courted him and just, you know, tried to convince him I was the guy for the job, and my enthusiasm level and everything. And then finally, it was actually January 26th. 2004, Andrew called me and said, welcome to the family. You know, and I was like, oh, I was so happy. And I think the best thing about it was my children were so excited because they loved the books. And they were very enthralled with it and very excited that their dad was going to be, you know, helping create the Narnian inhabitants. So it was a giant thrill and a magnificent, life-changing and life-altering experience. I mean, even down to the fact that, you know, I won an Oscar for best makeup for the film for Chronicles of Narnia. And you can't reward anybody more than that, you know, and just how much everybody loves the film. It's so positive and encouraging and supportive of everything. And on top of it, it's an outstanding movie. It's an absolutely fantastic film.
When you see the finished product on screen, I know it's an overused word here, awesome, but it really is awesome. But I just wondered for you, what were the specific challenges involved in this movie?
Well, everything was a challenge. I mean, the time frame was very tough. Like I said, we had 6 months to prep. And that might seem like a long time, but it's not. It went very, very fast. With all the different characters, we had 23 individual species, and we created almost 200 individual characters for this film. That's a lot of work in a very short period of time. I mean, Andrew always stressed the fact that he wanted everything to be as real as possible, nothing that was cartoony or characteristic, but really based in reality. And I believe that as well. I think if we had gone any other way, it would have been unsuccessful. But I mean, you know, Mr. Thomas was difficult only because we had very little access to James McAvoy during our pre-production period. James was on another show in London, and we were very limited to how we could. And that's not the way to go about doing a hero makeup. But, you know, luckily we were very resourceful. Myself and Tammy Lane, who was also won the Oscar, her and I worked hand in hand on the show. And you know, we just figured out how we were going to do this makeup best. And we went through a lot of trials and tribulations. The first 4 days we shot with Mr. Tumnus, he changed every day. Andrew would come at the end of the day and go, you know, I'd like to change this, and let's change the color of the hair. And so he alters for the first 4 days of the filming. And then finally, you know, it's not noticeable in the film, but then, you know, finally is the vision that he is.
Is there any way you could talk us through what would have been a fairly typical day on the set of Narnia?
Sure. Okay, let's see. Now, consider this. You've only slept for 5 hours, okay? So you get up at 3 a.m, and you go to set. It's pitch black and cold. You get there, and there's no food ready. So you facilitate your own needs and try to figure out how you're going to eat something before you have to work 6 hours at least to getting everybody ready. So everyone comes in, all the extras come in, and all the actors come in, and you start making them up. And there's this giant, enormous tent that's filled with makeup stations and dressing rooms and all tables and monsters and Narnian inhabitants everywhere. And everybody's assigned a specific group of characters. As makeup artists, because we had makeup artists and dressers and seamstresses and mechanics, and but makeup artists were normally had at least 6 makeups to do a day. You know, that's a lot of makeup to do, because we'd have like 30 fauns and 40 centaurs and, you know, 25 minotaurs and menobores and all these other crazy characters. And so we'd work and work and take about 6 hours to put everybody together. Then we would all go to set, and if, you know, when we were shooting at Flock Hill, which is where we did the battle, we would all helicopter up to the final shooting location, which is up in these amazing rocks. And you'd go up there, you'd pack up your backpack filled with, you know, snow gear, winter gear, sunny gear, and some food and water, and you'd get helicoptered up, be dropped up there until the sun went down. Then you'd come down with all the stuff, and then what we would do is at the end of the day clean everybody off, and which took about 2.5 hours, then clean all the suits off and get them ready for the next day. You know, wash all the smelly leotards, because all the guys that were wearing suits had to get in these black leotards before they got into their suits, and then head home and eat a little something and pass out and then do it again.
Leotard washing, I'm sure that's not really what you wanted to be there for.
No, but you know what, I did it. And that's the other thing too, is as like a, I guess I'll say a boss, although I never say you work for me, I always say you work with me, because that's the truth, you do it as a team. But I was the first guy to, you know, wash towels and leotards, sweaty stunt guy leotards, because everybody needed to do it. So if I do it, no one has an excuse, like, you know, not to do it. So that's how I like to work things on set.
What a wonderful attitude. I just wondered as well, when you're surrounded by all these amazing creatures, and then if you get a chance to go out and go to, you know, a restaurant or a bar, it must seem strange just being surrounded by people.
Sometimes it is, you know. We were shooting in really remote areas, so we were really segregated anyhow, and it was like where the wild things are. We were in the forest with the wild things for months and months. And when we moved down south, which is where we shot Aslan's camp and shot the battle sequence, which was about a good 8 weeks worth of filming, my department was very segregated, as well as the stunt players, and we just had ourselves to be with. So it just felt like you were with the fauns and the satyrs and the dwarves and the minotaurs, because we were always together for 8 weeks and nobody else, you know. But yeah, it takes a little bit to getting used to when you go and you have to be with boring old humans, when you could easily spend your day with a very exciting menobore.
Well, we can escape to that magical world once again. The Chronicles of Narnia coming to DVD on April the 4th. I just wondered though, are you a fan of DVDs, Howard?
Oh, I am. I'm a huge fan of DVDs, and I especially like when a DVD has an outstanding behind the scenes, selections. And this one does. I mean, I was lucky enough to see, or preview a lot of the behind the scenes, supplementary, footage, and it's really, really, really spectacular. I mean, it's chock full of fun stuff, and it really, really shows how much fun we were having on that set, you know, each day, and how great everybody worked together, and what a team effort it was, and how proud we were, and how excited we were, and how enthusiastic we were. So, I mean, I think it's a spectacular DVD. I mean, the movie itself speaks for itself. It's timeless, and it is a classic. And then to add this amazing behind the scenes documentary footage makes it even that much more fun, because you really get to see not so much how we did it, which I really like the fact that it wasn't put together like this is how, these are the secrets. It's not. It's really about this is how our hearts are, and this is how our hearts feel and felt while we were making this movie. And I felt that it was all approached just the right way and to keep in the tone of the film. So it's not so much a technical manual as it is a very personal, almost diary-esque, visual reference to what it was like to be on this movie.
Well, now you yourself, you're part of Oscar history. You've got the award itself. But let's go back a little bit. How did you find out that you'd received the nomination?
Well, that's a good story. I felt that I had a great possibility. I had a great chance of getting nominated. But, you know, you never count your chickens before they hatch. But so I woke up bright and early and on that Monday morning and sat by the TV and waited and waited and waited and waited. And, you know, they announced them, but of course they announced the stuff that nobody really cares about, you know, best picture, actors, that stuff. You know, people want to know who's nominated for best makeup. That's always the top one, and I think they just don't say it because of the suspense, you know, because everyone's waiting on the edge of their seat to hear. So anyhow, they didn't announce my category, and I went, okay, well, that's standard. Well, I got a call about 15 minutes after that from Mark Johnson, who's the executive producer of Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and he said, well, Howard, congratulations, and I just started welling up. and I'm so excited. And this has been a lifelong dream, a childhood dream, to be, you know, part of the history of the Oscars. And I was just so excited. And immediately I called all my sisters and got my kids up and ran around the house crazy, and then went to work and celebrated all day long at K&B. It was just a wonderful experience. But I also just love the fact that Mark Johnson called me, because he's become, aside from being a great, great producer, he's become a really great friend. And he, too, is part of the heart of Narnia. And it was just great to be told by him. And then Andrew called me later on that day and congratulated me. So it was wonderful.
Well, things got even better. Let's cut straight now to the Oscars themselves. Was this your first time at the ceremony?
It is. I had actually attended as a guest with Richard Taylor for Lord of the Rings, but it was my very first time to be nominated, and it was unbelievable. The whole entire month has been dreamlike, and I've been on cloud 9, 10, and 11, and it's really been wonderful. So, yeah, we all went to the Oscars and waited, and I felt I had a good chance again, but I wasn't about to nix out my competition, which was Cinderella Man and Star Wars. We were sitting there, and Will Ferrell and Steve Carell came out and announced, you know, the nominees. And then when Will Ferrell opened up that envelope and I started to see his mouth form an H, I knew I had it. And I heard the word, you know, Howard come out, and my heart just exploded. And I leaped up and kissed my wife and then grabbed Tammy by the hand. I'm like, come on, we only have a minute. So he ran up there so he could say the speech. And the rest of the night was just spectacular.
Now, did you get caught up in the whole Oscar experience, you know, the whole madness that goes with it before and after?
Yes, absolutely I did. I mean, it was just, I caught myself up in it. I was just so enthralled with it all. And it's, like I said, I started watching the Oscars when I was like 3 years old with my dad. And I've watched it every single year, no matter where I am in the world. And I'm always excited about it and never skeptical about it or cynical about it. I just love it.
Now, who threw the best party on the night?
I have to say Vanity Fair was pretty spectacular. We all piled into the limo and drove to Vanity Fair. Now, that was a very exclusive party, and they cut the number of people off at 500. So you had to be invited. It was very exclusive. So we pulled up and they said, do you have tickets? And we went, no. And they went, sorry, this is a private party. And we rolled the windows down and stuck two Oscars out. And they went, oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead. You have the best ticket in town. And so we went in, and Tammy and I ran around like crazy people, meeting celebrities and, you know, saying hi to everybody and really having a great time, really, really abusing the privilege of being Oscar winners that night, you know. I just didn't want to, like, go, hey, how you doing? And I felt I let everybody who wanted to hold the Oscar hold it, because I felt the more people hold it, the more good luck and positive energy it'll have. So everybody, anybody who was like, oh, can I see it? I'm like, see it here, hold it, see what it's like. So, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, from a waiter, you know, holding it to the George Clooney holding it, you know, not that he needed to hold it, he had his own. But, I mean, I really ran the gambit and just wanted to meet everybody. And I was just so proud and so happy and so excited about everything. I mean, for myself winning. But, you know, I always say that this win is for everybody that worked on the movie, everyone on my team, and it's a fantastic win for the movie and for Narnia and for Disney and Walden. So it's really a great thing for everybody involved.
How heavy is the actual statue?
I think it's about 8 pounds. I actually have it right here with me. I'm holding it right now. I can't seem to let go of it. lately it's been I had a meeting today and I took it with me. I'm like, I'm not leaving it at home by itself. So although it had a BAFTA to keep it company, but I'm not ready to just leave it at home by itself right now. So it sounds kind of crazy, but I just love it and cherish it so much, it's going to go some places with me. I'd say it's about 8 pounds, so it's kind of heavy, actually. It's a good workout.
It's funny, I did ask George Clooney where he was going to put his Oscar, and he said, it may sound a little obvious, but I was thinking about putting it on top of my car.
Well, that sounds good. I have a mantle over my fireplace where it's going to sit with the BAFTA right now and some other stuff and photos of my children. And actually, there's a photo of Mr. Tumnus, James McAvoy, as Mr. Tumnus right next to it. So I think it's a good place of honor between James McAvoy and my children.
One question I wanted to ask you. For me, this was my first time at the Oscars. I was lucky enough to be right down there on the red carpet. The thing that I never realized was that a lot of the people that walk up on the red carpet you think are going into the Academy Awards, these people are actually extras. And they're going nowhere but walking right up the red carpet, get to the end, go down the other side, and then come back up the red carpet again so that it always looks busy for the TV cameras. Is there something else that you can tell me that most people wouldn't know about the Oscars?
Well, yes, actually, it's divided into two lanes, a right and a left lane when you come in. If you're a nominee, you get to go down the left lane, which is where all the press is. If you're a guest, you get to go on the right side, where there's no press, and you walk by and wave and all that sort of stuff. So when I walked up, they said, to the right, sir, and I said, I'm a nominee, and they went, I'm sorry, to the left, sir. So myself and Dean Wright, who was nominated for Best Visual Effects as well, and Tammy Lane, we all walked down the left side and waved and, you know, got a few interviews and photos and so forth. So, you know, that was wonderful.
Was there anything, though, that surprised you at the Oscars that you didn't expect or you didn't think would be there?
I'll tell you what, no one really, I didn't expect, and what surprised me was standing next to Nicole Kidman and how tall she is. I was standing there, and I would have never known it was her, and I went, and then I saw her face, and I went, oh my gosh, that is Nicole Kidman, and boy, is she tall. And granted, she was wearing, you know, high heels, but still, very, very tall woman, and unbelievably beautiful, which I knew that, but I'd say that was a big surprise. And then, of course, winning was even a better surprise.
Well, just one final thing. Just take us through that moment. Your name's been read out. You're now on that stage, and you look out, and you just see what?
This is what I saw. I saw everybody. Like, I was hoping the lights would blind me, but they don't. But the most intimidating thing that you look out at is a time clock that's ticking away at the time you have left before Bill Conti starts up the orchestra and you are silenced. So I watched that clock and I started off, and you know, I was very careful. I chose my words carefully prior and had written a speech and memorized it to some degree. And the night before, my partner Greg said, you should say something about George Clooney. Say at least George doesn't do makeup. And I went, oh, that's good. Because at the BAFTAs, we were having a drink with George before we went, and George said, listen, if you guys win, do a shout out for me, and if I win, I'll do a shout out for you. And okay, sounds great. So we had won. We got out there and we said, you know, we want to, and last but not least, we want to thank George Clooney for this award. Looked down and George was laughing. Unfortunately, at the BAFTAs, George didn't win, so we didn't get a shout out. I was hoping he was going to reciprocate at the Oscars, you know, but I figured he had some other stuff on his mind, so I'll let him slide this time. You know, I said the joke and looked down at George, and he was laughing again. And I felt I went ahead and said my speech the way I needed to, and what I wanted to say and who I thanked was appropriate. And then it was over before I knew it, and we were walking off the stage with Steve Carell and Will Ferrell up to take photos and press photos and interviews and the whole shebang. It was unbelievable. It was more than I ever expected.
Well, now it's our chance to thank you, Howard. Absolutely brilliant. Congratulations once again on your amazing Oscar win. Well done.
Well, thank you very much. And it's been thrilling. And I can't wait to start on the next film.
Well, that's it for this month. Thank you once again to Mark Dindal and to Howard Berger. And be on the lookout for Chicken Little on DVD March 21st and The Chronicles of Narnia on April 4th. I'm Ross King. Thanks for tuning in.